A podcast of the cinema.
Who's in this podcast?
Why, that would be you and me. I'm Alonzo Duraldi, reviews editor at The Wrap and co-host of the Who Shot Ya Breakfast All Day and a Film and a Movie podcast, in addition to this one. And you're Dave White, film critic, co-host of this program.
Yes. Film critic for no one but this program at the moment.
At the moment.
I'm on furlough.
Yes. But you have a, you know, check out Dave's Rotten Tomatoes page and pack a lunch. He's got plenty.
I'm quite accomplished.
So very. You're prolific. You've been prolific.
Yes.
At times in your life.
Yes. Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Oh, fine.
Hey.
Yes.
We're getting right into it.
Oh, okay.
Normally, at this time of the podcast, would be the time where we hem and haw for 10 minutes.
I was going to say, I have Shilly Shally written here on
talking
the run of the
about,
show, and you're going to skip right over
various
it.
Cakes and things that I've been making.
Mm-hmm.
But not only am I on furlough, I'm also on punishment. I'm on self-punishment. oh, you think it's funny.
What are you punishing yourself for?
I'm on
for?
Self-punishment. I'm fixing to say so. Tell everyone exactly about it.
Oh, right, yes, okay, right.
Our last episode, I began the episode goofing on Sufjan Stevens.
Yes.
For his
complaints about the Oscars.
For his complainy cantankerousness.
Yes.
About the Academy Awards. And during that process, I said something that was wrong.
Mm.
And though I have not heard any feedback about it from any listener, I do want to address it all the same.
We also removed it from the episode.
I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
It was at the beginning of the episode. It began with me fuming ridiculously about him and the Academy Awards. And in the process, without thinking about it, I inadvertently othered him.
Hmm.
Because I didn't know where his first name came from. I asked if he had made it up himself as a stage name, you know, or if his parents named him that, and it was in passing, as sort of like, I'm wondering about this pop star's name. And it wasn't meant to be a joke or a goof or, you know, anything like that. That was just me being an idiot out loud long after the episode was posted. I was still thinking about him, and I did a little homework, and then I found out, oh, hey, dummy dum-dum, Sufjan Stevens is Persian. Yeah. That is the origin of his name, and I felt stupid, because my actual Persian friends in real life over the years have taught me enough to know this. But I was thoughtless and I was careless. Now, if you are going back now to go listen to that bit, you will probably not find it. We wound up cutting the 8 seconds of audio after the episode was posted, and I wanted to cut it for one reason only. Not to cover my ass or anything, because I can handle being an idiot in public, but what I cannot handle is
being an idiot for the record.
No.
Okay.
I'm going to tell people what I can't handle being an idiot about. Okay. I can't handle the idea of hurting my friend's feelings.
Sure.
Even if I didn't mean to.
Of course.
You know? Because sometimes you do it, even if you don't mean to. And I think not only do people in real life that we know who are our friends who listen to this show, but people who are listening who don't know us, y'all are, I mean, this is not a big, huge, popular show. I think of the listeners as my friends. Like, I don't want to have something out there in the world that would sort of repeatedly, possibly hurt someone's feelings, you know? And like I say, again, I didn't make fun of him having an unusual name. I just like, where'd that name come from?
Mm.
Here's the thing. It's the same thing people do to Ingu.
Mm.
Only when they do it to Ingu, they're doing it maliciously.
Well, yeah.
And you can tell it because it's on Twitter and they're like, hey, what kind of name is that? You know, and it makes my blood boil. And so for me to do it inadvertently and then realize later what I had done.
Sure.
I don't like it, and I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. Mm. So, you know, you get film directors' names that throw me all the time, and I go do my homework, I go look it up, I go learn how to pronounce
it. We learned how to say Apichatpong Virasethicon.
Yeah, and so, you know, that is the thing. And if you're listening and you're thinking, why is he making a big deal of this, you know, when we have actual neo-Nazis running the country, that's the lowest bar, right?
Yeah.
You don't want to aspire to the lowest bar, only passing the lowest bar.
Right.
You want to become better at being a human being as often as you can, not worse.
Yes. It starts with individuals deciding that they are not going to be crappy to other individuals. And
also reiterating that I am a fan of Sufjan Stevens and think he's an idiot for his complaints about the Academy Awards.
None of that has changed.
But yes.
Okay.
No more accidental othering. The end.
Good.
Yes. We only have four films to talk about. The first one is... All right, you've seen The Glorious. I haven't.
Uh-huh.
Probably, maybe I will eventually. I don't know. Christy liked it, right?
She did.
You didn't like it.
I did not. I think I'm generally...
Do you like
the...
it less than The Boys in the Band? Or do you hate The Boys in the Band more than you hate The Glorious?
They both annoy me on different fronts, although they are both annoying in the same way in terms of getting the past in a weirdly airless, you know, kind of way.
All
you
right.
know, they're both about the changes of the 60s
right.
in regards to, you know, gender and sexuality and civil rights.
Yeah.
They both also feel like these both, okay, another thing they have in common is they both have previous takes on the story that I found much more interesting and much more, you know, like moving and involving.
Right.
And they both feel kind of airless. But, you know, okay. beyond that, they're very
well, let's
different.
Start with The Boys in the Band.
Let's do that.
But before we talk about this film remake,
mm-hmm.
let's talk about the original film. Right. And the play
and the
that
play
it was based,
based
on. And I also want to know about your first experience seeing that film.
Okay.
Because I had a definite first experience seeing that film in the early 90s.
Me too.
Yeah. Okay.
So I came out in 1988 after I graduated from college. If you've listened to this show, you've heard some version of this story before.
Yeah.
In early 1989, I moved to Dallas, Texas, for my first sort of real job after college. I was working for a newspaper that no longer exists called the Dallas Times-Herald. I was just coming out, and I was just coming out, you know, like in the full blush of the AIDS pandemic. ACT UP and Queer Nation and all of that stuff was unfolding around me. So I was very much like capital G gay. I was reading all the books that I could get my hands on, and I was hanging out in the neighborhood, and I was just like, you know, fully...
What neighborhood?
The Oak Lawn neighborhood of Dallas.
All right.
Where the gays were. And just...
Did you eat at Hunky's?
I ate at Hunky's at least once a week.
What?
Oh, well,
really?
Because
that often?
Because
all right.
I got involved with an organization called Gay Lesbian Young Adults.
Oh, and y'all would all go after it. Because it was like where you go to Frogurt after youth,
exactly.
church youth group.
Right,
okay.
right. We would all go to Hunky's and get a burger. Anyway, and so one of the establishments that I frequented in the Oak Lawn neighborhood was Tape Lenders Video.
Right.
Which
me,
is
me too.
Which is somehow still
the
there.
Oh, really?
I think.
They still exist?
Yeah. Like, I don't know if they have a single tape on hand, but they do. There's still a store, the last time I checked anyway, Who knows now?
They should have their tapes for archival use purposes.
With the pandemic and all. There was the last time I looked, there was still a store called Tape Lenders in Oak Lawn. Anyway, so Tape Lenders was a video store. And, you know, they had the new releases. They had the adult material. But they also had...
The most... Okay, well, can we just digress for a moment on this?
Why not?
Porn in the early 90s was the most boring thing.
Well, I think it was one of those things like
gay porn anyway.
It was one of those things like a lot of things before the internet.
Right.
You didn't know how to sort of narrow cast yet.
No, the studios that were putting it out were just sort of like, let's appeal to the broadest possible.
Exactly.
Well, guess what?
Unless you like
None of those guys looked like Ed Asner.
Right. Well, unless you...
And this was very disappointing to me.
Unless you were like dug deep and, you know, probably filled in the tiny ad in the back of the magazine to get some really like low-budgety kind of leathery or whatever sub thing. Yeah. Yeah, most of the early 90s porn was very glossy, very like... it was very 80s,
there was
frankly.
So much baby oil happening.
So much depilatory going
on. Okay, go on.
Anyway, Tape Lenders had a gay and lesbian section.
Right.
That's what they called it.
The whole store was the gay and lesbian section.
Well, right, but they had a...
But let's be real.
They had a specific wall that was like...
Specifically gay, queer,
yes.
oriented material.
The corner that you would go to
Not
get
porn,
like...
Not porn, but right, yes.
You'd get like Parting Glances and Desert Hearts and My Beautiful Laundrette and...
Claire of the Moon.
Of the Moon. And La Cage aux Folles, and you know, the Killing of Sister George, all of that stuff was in this one corner. That corner became like my crash course education.
Right. Yes.
All the movies that I had read about in the celluloid closet but had never seen,
right.
because where would I?
Where would you have seen them? Right.
Yeah. So they had the boys in the band, and I was like, I got to see this movie. I know it's important. I know we now sort of look down upon it, but I know it matters. I'm going to see this thing. And I took home the tape, and I watched it. And it was like, oh, my God, this is depressing.
Right.
Like, on the one hand, yes, it is a very funny play, and it has a lot of sharply barbed kind of the women style, you know, bitchy dialogue.
Right.
But it portrays a gay life that was unrecognizable to what I was currently experiencing at that age in that era of history.
Yes.
And so to me, it was like, okay, I get it. This is how it was for somebody at some point, but it's not me now.
Right.
I'm glad this exists. I'm glad I can sort of look at it. And it actually may have taken me a while to get to, I'm glad it's existing, glad to look at it. At the time, it's like, ugh. I can't believe this. And I think part of the reason that I was sort of horrified by it was, again, that gay and lesbian section at the video store was not huge.
It was not.
You know, this is on
the little chunk of the wall.
This is 89-90 that I'm looking at this. So, like, the new queer cinema hasn't happened yet.
Right.
So if you are somebody who wants to talk about, like, gay images in cinema, the boys in the band at that point loomed like the monolith in 2001.
Yes.
And thus...
Correct.
It was like, this is all we got? Really? You know? Because, like, by that point, I had seen Parting Glances, which I totally identified with, and a lot of it felt very recognizable to me. This other thing was like, And if there had been other options, and like then you can be like, okay, fine, it's this piece of history, and it's trapped in amber or whatever. But, yeah.
You and I came out roughly at the same time, but you dove into queer culture before I did.
Okay.
I was very busy just having lots of sex. And so...
Clearly I did it all wrong.
And so that... What I did... When I got... when I moved back to the DFW area, I too started going to Tape Lenders. But this was at the time of the new queer cinema.
Gotcha.
So I had already seen in theaters Poison and The Living End. And those were my first gay movies.
Wow.
Right? So, and then Swoon. And the first things I gravitated toward at Tape Lenders was things like, you know,
Kenneth Anger
and Flaming Creatures and Bruce LaBruce's No Skin Off My Ass and Vaginal Davis's video zine called Fertile LaToya Jackson.
Right.
And so all the things that looked punk rockish to me is where I started.
Carell?
I did not see Carell for a very long time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But that's where I started. And I had heard enough about the boys in the band to think, yeah, not that's not mine.
Yeah.
That's not for me. I don't need that.
That's a sweater movie.
But then, yeah, that's a gay sweater movie. That was a shorthand code for older gays, not like me.
Respectable.
They tuck in their shirts. Yes, you know what I mean? Yes. Like that.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, eventually, somebody did a repertory screening of it in Dallas, and I cannot remember now if it was USA Film Festival.
I don't think so. Or probably those guys that did the, not the Texas Theater.
It wasn't. It wasn't at, it wasn't the Grand.
The Grand. Okay.
It was. It was actually a screening that was that happened at the Lakewood Theater.
Oh.
Yeah. So my friend Carl and I go see it because he had seen it.
Okay.
And he was like, he said to me, honey, I have to show this to you. All right, so we go.
And you had dragged him to countless art films by
that
point.
Oh, so. I had already ruined him by dragging him to this or that, like, difficult film that he didn't want to see.
Right.
And when it was over, I was so bummed out. For a couple of reasons, and one of them is relevant to this remake.
Okay.
I'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
Mostly because I couldn't imagine. I had exactly three gay friends at that point.
Right.
In my life. Three gay male friends. That's it. All my friends were my friends from college that I hung out with and went to see bands with. Gay culture was something that I sort of tiptoed into. On my own terms and in my own time.
Yeah.
Not because I thought it was better than it, but because it felt sort of alien to me.
Yeah.
And I didn't quite know what I was supposed to do with it or what I was supposed to be getting from it.
Right.
But I remember thinking the most important thing after seeing the film was, I never want to have friends like this. Because this is, for those of you who do not know anything about this is a film that is the, of a play. And the play is a one-set, one, you know, environment play where about nine different gay dudes in various stages of, you know, coming to terms with their identity shred each other mercilessly.
Yes.
This, they are actively reading to filth their best friends.
Yeah.
Not in that way where, okay, so like we're on a group chat, right? We have a little group of about half a dozen people that we're on a group chat with. Our best friends here in the city.
It's the pandemic. We're all doing it.
But even before that group chat began, our little group of friends is the kind that routinely busts each other's balls in a way that is what I consider to be camaraderie building.
Yes.
You know, it's
done
it's,
with love.
Everyone is laughing. Everyone is seeing who can say the most outlandish and even the most absurd insult. It's never like no one is ever taking an actual weak spot or shortcoming in the other friend and
drilling at it,
correct. And so watching this movie, I thought, I never want to have friends like that. They're so vicious and cruel to each other. Who would want to hang around that? Because the three gay friends that I had built, you know, that I had found in the DFW area, they were funny and they were smart and they were kind and we had, you know, fun together. We saw, you know, movies together and we talked about music together and none of them ever came to see a band with me. That was always the other friends. But like I was making the kind of gay male friends that I wanted to have. Not, we weren't just thrown together because we were gay.
Right.
We had the privilege of it being the 90s,
yes,
and having a larger pool of friends to choose from. And I can only think that earlier, when it was harder to meet and find each other, or other than sexually,
right,
that you maybe sometimes you just became friends with people by default.
Well, I mean, like, you know, remember in the documentary Small Town Gay Bar? It's like, yeah, if you're the one tiny gay bar for hundreds of miles, yeah, around, that's where you go. And if, like, if you have nothing in common with the other folks there and you come from different backgrounds and, yeah, you have different interests and whatever, you're stuck.
And it meant that, you know, all the cruelty that is visited upon us as queer people in the world, mm-hmm, really, no matter where in the country you live, no matter how relatively liberal, you know, your environment is that you grew up in, there's going to be somebody that you cross paths with who hates you for no reason other than the fact that you are queer.
Right.
And if the older you are, the more exposure to that sort of thing you've probably had.
Yeah.
You know, you and I were both born in the 60s, and we became, you know, young adult men in the late 80s and became openly, you know, gay in around that time as well. Mm-hmm. And by that point, we had plenty of time, both of us, to absorb the casual, passively accepted homophobia and anti-gay hate,
yes,
that has been embedded in American culture,
right,
forever.
Yeah.
So,
good luck finding an 80s comedy where somebody doesn't drop an F-bomb.
Correct. We were lucky in that regard that when we saw the Boys of the Band for the first time, we could say, oh my God, I'm glad I was only 4 years old when this happened,
right,
because the world's different now. Clearly it is. This is not my experience. My friends are good to me.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get away from it as fast as I could. Like, I felt like it was going to catch me and trap me if I stuck around any longer than the running time. Like, if I even gave it more thought than I needed to after it was over, I thought, oh. Like, it was like the monster that's always ready to drag you back down into the pit and torture you. And then, on a personal note, mm-hmm, Harold.
Yes.
The actor who played Harold in the first film, his name was
Leonard Fry, who also plays the tailor in Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah. Now, Leonard Fry, I don't know what his face actually looked like, but in The Boys in the Band, they are either highlighting his actual face, or they have added scarring to it.
Prosthetically, yeah.
Prosthetically. But he has visible scarring on his face.
Right.
These are acne scars that a lot of people get as teenagers, and you grow up and you still have them. Mm. Well, the amount of scarring that is on Leonard Fry's face in The, yeah, Boys in the Band is a delicate wisp compared to the minefield of acne scarring that I experienced as a teenager and that I carried with me into adulthood.
Right.
To this day, I'm 56 years old, and if you look at my face for the first time, you will say to yourself in your brain, oh, look at the scars on his face. And after you know me for a while, you probably don't see him anymore, but my face is very scarred. And so, when I left that film, I thought, oh, that's the kind of scarring that will get people to hate you? Great.
Well,
now I'm doomed forever.
Also, though, the play makes it clear that his scarring is self-inflicted. Michael talks about attacking his own face, yeah, with tweezers and,
yes,
stuff.
But teenagers yes, with acne do attack their own faces to try to get rid of it, to make it go away faster, you know.
Right.
So when they were talking about that in the film, I thought, ooh. Now, this was, of course, just a residual thing in my own head.
Sure.
Because what I had already learned in the first 2 years of coming out was that there's a whole subset of men who enjoy the company of a man with a rough-looking complexion. God bless them.
A weathered gentleman.
That's correct. Doesn't matter how old you are, how young you are. If you got a scarred face, they like you. So I was experientially over it.
Yeah.
Knew better.
Yeah.
But, you know, someone starts talking stuff like that to your face, and you're like, oh, no, oh, no.
Flashbacks.
I'm 16 again. Leave me alone. Like, yeah. And that is a thing that we will talk about again as we discuss this remake. But the original Boys in the Band, I think, is, it doesn't matter if you can relate to it.
Right.
It is an important historical document.
Totally. And one thing that I've come to appreciate about it as I have become more of a cineast,
yes,
is that I really appreciate what William Friedkin, who directed the 1970 film version, is doing in terms of, so often when people bring a play to the screen, they do what they call opening up. It's like, how do we get these characters out in the world, and how do we like move them around so we're not just stuck in a room? Like, let's send everybody in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf off to the roadhouse for a while and then bring them back home again.
Right.
Friedkin does the opposite. Friedkin enhances, like, makes you feel closed in, like, really leans into the whole, the suffocating closeness of it all.
Yeah.
You see the sweat on people's brow and on their upper lip.
Yes, you do.
And that's why, like, you know, he did two Tracy Letts adaptations. He did Bug and he did Killer Joe, and I thought that comes in with both of them. And
he's very good at that sort of thing.
I so wish he had gotten to do the August Osage County movie, because that movie needed that sense of, oh, I'm trapped with these terrible people.
Right.
So anyway, so on that level, I've come to appreciate the movie more. The other, I think you should also share our other Boys in the Band anecdote about the original movie, which is when it first came out on DVD.
Oh, yeah. I was, you were an editor at The Advocate.
Yes.
You were not my editor at The Advocate, thankfully. I was a contributing writer to The Advocate in the early 2000s, back when they were still a good magazine, not run by someone who gives money to Trump.
Yes.
And, which is what's happening right now, by the way, just FYI.
I don't know if it's Trump, but it's definitely to anti-LGBT Republican.
That's Trump and all the other Nazis.
Okay,
that's who that is.
Okay, yeah. I don't want emails about how we got it wrong.
Oh, we're not getting anything wrong. This guy gives money to Republicans who hate us and want to legislate against us, and he owns The Advocate.
That is correct.
I can't remember his name, or I would name his name right now.
Yes, name him and shame him.
Anyway, the where was I going with
Advocate,
this?
Advocate article.
I had this big idea for the DVD release. Hey, what if I take some young guys I know in their 20s, because I was almost 40 or fixing to be 40?
I guess so.
What if I take some dudes in their 20s that I know and make them all sit down and watch Boys in the Band at the same time in at our apartment?
For the first time.
Yeah, for the first time. So I found like three or four of our young, at the time, friends. They're all real old now. and I said, hey, I've got a horror movie to show you. Come on over. And they did. And I will always remember at the end, Juan looking at me and saying, can I go home now? I feel very bad, and I want to go home. He said, you cannot go home. I'm here to feed you some cake. We're gonna lift the mood with some treats. But the, yeah, and that was a good article.
Yeah, they were all sort of appalled by it.
They were all appalled and bummed out, and the same way I felt.
Yeah.
And they said, well, what was it like when you first watched it? I said, exactly the same, because I watched it in the 90s, which was still 20 years after. 20 plus years after its thing. This is a whole other generation removed now. So that was a good experience.
Yeah.
And now, Ryan Murphy.
If you
got his hot little hands on it.
If you subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/linoleumknife,
right,
on LKTV, we endured all of Hollywood.
Every episode of Hollywood.
To talk about Hollywood.
Yeah.
And
now, I hate this version somewhat less than you do.
Okay.
But go on.
I bring up Hollywood specifically because there is... Ryan Murphy seems to get so excited about the art direction and the costuming and the period detail. And he does nail a lot of it, although he nails it in a shiny, just off the showroom floor kind of way.
Generally, yeah. That's the same way in this film.
Yeah. And it, I think sometimes...
Everything looks good, but nothing looks lived in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It all looks new. I think it undercuts the drama, and it undercuts the trauma, the historical trauma that these pieces are trying to explore.
Mm-hmm.
I did not see the 2018 Broadway revival, which features this cast, which Murphy produced, which Joe Mantello directed. He also directed this, although he's not really a filmmaker. The last time he directed anything was Love, Valor, Compassion, which is another movie of a stage play. To me, I just, this felt sort of suffocated by the art direction in the way that Murphy's pieces often do, unless it's something like People versus OJ or Pose, where clearly like other hands have come in to really sort of take over and run the show. I referred to this movie in my review at the Wrap as Waxwork Karaoke. And I thought just a lot of it didn't land for me at all. And it wasn't because of my relationship with the material or the age of the material. It's just in the way that it's being enacted. It's particularly for me, the two... I mean, this is very much an ensemble piece, but the two sort of central combatants here who are played by two of the bigger names.
Right.
You're the host. I don't have all the names in front of me, but... who's played by Jim Parsons.
Yes.
And then...
Michael/Mickey.
Michael and Harold. Harold, who is the aforementioned pockmarked guest, who is the whose birthday they're all ostensibly celebrating,
right.
Who's played by Zachary Quinto. Yeah,
that's the thing. It's a birthday party.
Well,
it's a birthday party, and instead of having a birthday party fun time, it's a birthday party where everyone... competes to take the giantest poop on each other.
Well, and again, as I also
not
said...
Not literally.
No. As I also said in my Wrap review, as groundbreaking as The Boys in the Band is as a portrayal of an aspect of queer life on the Broadway stage,
right.
It is very old-fashioned in a, let's get a bunch of characters in a room and ply them with alcohol and then have them hurl accusations and, dark secrets and truths
right.
at each other.
Right.
That's... a little hokier, but that's what we're dealing with here. That's the genre that we're working within. I think there are some individual good performances in here. I liked Andrew Randles and Tuck Watkins a lot. I only just learned that they apparently became an actual couple after being in the Broadway show together.
Oh, fascinating!
Which is okay. Interesting. I liked Robin DeJesus, who I have been a fan of ever since Camp.
Right.
As Emery, who is the most sort of outrageously flamboyant of the group.
Yeah.
I feel, however, the movie is cheating, and I guess the play was cheating as well, by casting a Latinx actor in this role, because one of the subcurrents here is there is one black character in this, Bernard, who is a librarian, who's played by Michael Benjamin Washington. He's also terrific. Emery constantly peppers him with these sort of like, quote-unquote, jokey, racist references.
Yes.
Like bringing up like mammies or whatever. Like
yes.
It's this constant yes. thing. And it's this back and forth that they have. And at one point, when everybody's all getting all confronty with each other, somebody asks Bernard why he takes it, why he puts up with it. And he basically has this whole monologue about how, like, because Emery is so outrageously, unhideably gay that he, you know, is allowed that, and nobody else is, because
right.
he also sort of suffers at the hand of the man, basically.
Yes.
If you cast an actor of color in that role, it doesn't have the same impact as if you have a white guy in that role, because that whole subplot is specifically about
right.
racism, and racism from a white guy to a black guy is different than racism from a person of color to another person of color.
You do also have in this remake... Jim Parsons saying the N-word twice
to Bernard.
Hmm. And so, I agree with you about the casting of Robin DeJesus as a softening element for that stuff, but then they go right in on the white racism of the moment and of all moments.
Yeah, but again, but that's in the Jim, that's the text.
You it is. I understand that is the text, but they don't flinch from that.
Fair enough.
Okay,
I will grant you that.
But anyway,
but Parsons and Quinto, I think, are the weakest links here. Like part, of the, and they have the dialogue that is the sharpest and most. It's like the funniest, but also the most barbed.
Yes,
and they don't quite nail either. Like so much of the stuff that Michael says, whether it's self-pitying or whether it's aggressive to somebody else, doesn't land the way that it with the impact that it should. And Harold has like some of the most cutting bon mot of this
the
whole,
meanest of dialogue of the film. Yeah,
and Quinto delivers them with this deadly solemnity that it does not. It's never funny, and it's never bitching or cutting or anything. It's just sort of like it's so solemn that it just sucks all the life out of this stuff. So yeah, I think a lot of the there's some good work here, and I'm not against the idea of reviving this play every so often. In theory, I think that yes, while it doesn't necessarily apply to most people's lives today, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't explore the past and talk about it and look at what lives were like. And again, even at the time, The Boys in the Band is about a very select niche of like New York urbanites.
Yes.
It's certainly as again,
it
no,
couldn't, it could not possibly represent everyone.
Right.
It represented the people that Mark Crowley knew.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And no single work can. It's just that it was for a long time the only game in town when it came to gay theater.
I mean, Not to be at all critical of the original, it is a landmark of visibility.
Oh, no question.
You know, that thing that Harvey Fierstein says in The Celluloid Closet. Yeah. Visibility
at
all costs.
Yeah.
You know, when you were in a world where you weren't even allowed to be known to exist.
Yeah.
Other than as, you know, a dirty secret, a shameful thing that people shouldn't talk about.
A pathetic foil.
Yeah, to have a film about only gay men talking to each other was groundbreaking. Continue.
And what's groundbreaking about this version, obviously both on stage and in the film, is that this is an entirely openly gay cast.
This one is, yes.
This one is.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, that in itself, I think, represents...
That's a good thing.
...represents a way forward and in a sort of semiotic way, kind of comments upon how old-fashioned, or not how old-fashioned, but how this show is of another era.
In yeah, yeah. It's over 50 years old.
The Broadway revival, this one happened in 2018 for the 50th anniversary of the play.
Yeah.
This movie is happening for the 50th anniversary of the 1970 film.
Yes.
I was going to say I'm glad it exists. I don't know that I'm glad it exists.
I don't know that I'm glad this exists, other than as a stunt of casting. Because, again, we now have not only a lot of openly gay actors, gay male actors. Mm. We have a lot of openly gay male actors who are, like, well-known.
Yeah.
And so that's...
Matt Bomer's in this.
That's a great big shift in the culture. All right. Here's what I liked.
Okay.
The way it looked.
Okay.
And as a way in for someone who hasn't been able to see the original or who doesn't have access to it, either streaming or on a physical media.
It is weirdly currently not streaming. I don't know what that's about.
I'm gonna be real cutting right now and say that Ryan Murphy probably had that put in his contract.
Probably. He didn't want to.
The original cannot exist as competition for me. That's just me being a mean, cruel homosexual. All right.
Did you see the documentary, by the way, about the writing of this play, Making the Boys?
I have not seen it.
Oh, it's really good. Anyway, go ahead.
I like the way it looks. I like that it might be a way in for people who are curious to go look at the original.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what I didn't like. Well, no, let me say one more thing I liked. In spite of the fact that I think they have done a great disservice to the character and to the play itself by not giving Zachary Quinto the skin he needs to have on his face to play this part. I liked his performance as a kind of performance. You know what I mean? That, well, you and you and your dumb little friends. Right, like, but that I'm not here to argue with you about it.
I know.
I am here to say that I liked that lazy aggression that he gives to this character. It's not as arch a performance as Leonard Fry, because Leonard Fry takes up all the screen, all the room as that character. And when you finish that film, you will always remember him. Yeah. Like, more than anyone else in the movie, you will remember Leonard Fry as Harold. In the words of another queer friend this week, we think he was actually having a good time at this party. We think Harold was actually having a good time. So, but here's what I don't like. Go ahead and cast Zachary Quinto as Harold on stage. Because on stage, you can cast Ethel Merman as a 32-year-old and get away with it. You can cast Carol Channing as Hello Dolly when she's 85. You can cast
David Bowie as the Elephant Man and put no prosthetics on him.
Right. Do you see what I mean? The stage is different.
Yes.
You are not looking at someone's face close up, filling a screen.
Right.
If your face is going to fill the screen, which is what happens in this film.
And you're going to call yourself pockmarked.
And you're going to call yourself pockmarked, then the prosthetic makeup department needs to put at least more than two on your left cheek. Because when the film opens, you do see them. It is the very first shot of the film. You see him behind in a silhouette in a kind of half light, and you see a little sort of couple of divity marks on his cheek. But you don't know what character it is yet, especially if you haven't seen the film ever before, and you don't know who this character is supposed to be. You have to know that it's Harold, and you have to know that that's something on his face that you should be looking for.
I didn't even spot it until you pointed it out to me when you watched it.
And so, if the rest of the film is, I'm Zachary Quinto with curly hair and big oversized glasses.
And I'm so ugly.
I'm so ugly. Well, guess what? Zachary Quinto, you're so handsome. You're so very handsome. All day. Every day, and for the rest of your life. So very handsome. So, give me the prosthetics required to believe this person talk about how ugly he is all the time. Mm. And everyone else to talk about the attacks that he creates on his own face. Where's the evidence of this? I see no evidence of this.
Right.
And that is Ryan Murphy's fault.
Yes.
That is the fault of someone who doesn't want you to have to look at someone who's even a little less than cute.
Yeah.
And that goes for every single thing that Ryan Murphy has ever put on a screen, whether small or large. So
after he gets the acid thrown in his face, can he still look like Finn Wittrock?
Exactly. To quote the perfect and beautiful Guy Branum on Twitter, for Zachary Quinto to talk about how ugly he is camp.
Yes. Exactly.
All right.
Oh, Guy always nails it.
Here's the other thing. Here are some other things I do not like about this production.
Okay.
I do not like the part where they're playing the telephone game and talking about their pasts, the people they loved.
Yeah.
I do not like The cutaways to misty watercolored memories.
Yeah.
Because what that does is it softens the harshness of the film. Yeah. And you are meant to take away a feeling of dejected despair. That is what you were meant to take away from this film. Then again, at the end, another thing I don't like is the epilogue that is not in the original film.
Nope.
Everybody gets a little epilogue. And again, it softens the blow.
Yeah.
Do not soften the blow of the boys in the band, or you do not have the boys in the band.
Exactly.
You have, wouldn't it be nice if life were just a little kinder to everyone? Well, yeah, of course it would be nice, but that's not what this film is.
Yeah, like, my, why don't, go ahead and set it in the post-Hollywood universe where Rock Hudson made the world safe for gay people or something.
Right.
I mean, yeah, it's one thing to not, like, you know, accentuate the claustrophobia in the way that Friedkin does. But it's another thing to go even further in the other direction with these cutaways and these flashbacks and this afterword and all this stuff. It's like, oh, why do you keep taking me out of this apartment? I should feel trapped in this apartment.
Not a good thing.
It's funny. I have not watched the 70 version in a while. I'm going to watch it again before we talk about this movie on Who Shot You this week. But even as somebody who has seen it like two or three times and not in several years, there were so many times this movie was like, oh, well, that's where that shot's from. Oh, that's where that shot's from. Oh, that. And it's like, it's again, with the cutaways and everything, keep it from being the, you know, the Gus Van Sant psycho. But boy, are they borrowing so much. I mean, from the way Michael's car drives in from the Hamptons, or not Michael's,
Matt Bomer. I forget the character's name.
Donald.
All right. Okay.
To just a lot of the individual shots, like the especially the big monologue shots, like the, yes. of Zachary Quinto or whatever. Yeah. So it's frustrating.
I don't want to, you know, prescribe the boundaries of queer art.
Mm-hmm.
But don't take the ugly past and tell me it wasn't that way.
Yeah.
Just because you wish it had been that way. You know, don't Hollywoodize...
Yeah, Hollywood in quotes.
Hollywood, the TV show. Don't Hollywoodize this other real thing. Yeah. You know, have a fantasy about Rock Hudson coming out in the 50s all day long if you want. Do it well. You didn't. But do it well and we might have something.
Sure.
Right? Yeah, this is
not the place for that.
This is not the place to do that.
Yeah. So this was going to be like our usual weekly episode where we did a roundup of all the things, but we kind of went full Mamma Mia 2 on Boys in the Band.
How long have we talked about
like
Boys in the Band?
47 minutes about the Boys in the Band.
Okay.
So here's the thing.
Well, you know, we had a lot to say.
Yeah. We're gonna table the Glorias and the other stuff we were going to talk about until next time, but we have plenty more to say about the history of queer people as portrayed on film and other titles you might check out if you are interested in the subject now that you've watched this.
But first. Well, there's an advertisement.
We have a new sponsor, y'all.
It's not Ovid.
No.
It was Ovid.
And now it's not.
Now it's not Ovid. Now it's someone new.
Yes. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, Film Movement Plus.
Yes.
Film Movement Plus opens up a world of provocative, compelling, and award-winning films from Film Movement's singular library. The streaming video-on-demand subscription service currently available on Roku, Apple TV, Amazon Fire, Android TV, mobile, iOS and Android, and Chromecast offers customers immediate access to more than 350 festival-favorite feature films. I can say that twice.
Festival
favorite feature films.
Festival favorite feature films.
And 100 short films, including Thebe, the 2016 Academy Award nominee for Best Foreign Film, After the Storm, a powerful family drama from 2018 Palme d'Or winner Hirokazu Koreeda.
It's so good. I saw it in its theatrical run.
Mm-hmm.
And if you like Koreeda, and if you don't, who even are you?
Exactly.
Please, yeah, do watch After the Storm.
Human Capital, a political thriller from Paolo Virzi that was Italy's best foreign film submission for the 87th Academy Awards, and My Love, Don't Cross That River, an unforgettable documentary about true love that transcends generations and cultures and is South Korea's most successful film of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Classics from the Film Movement catalog include Billy August's Pele the Conqueror, an Academy Award winner for best foreign film in 1996. No, that can't be right. 1996?
No, I thought it was earlier than 96.
I thought it was earlier than that too. I don't know. We'll check on that. And much more. Here's a special offer for Linoleum Knife listeners.
Right.
Because you guys are in this. Get a 30-day free trial plus...
30 days for free. Do you know how much you can watch for free?
In 30 days?
A lot.
Plus 50% off your first 3 paid months. Use promo code KNIFE at checkout when you go to filmmovementplus.com/checkout. Again, that's promo code KNIFE, KNIFE, at filmmovementplus, all one word, .com.
It's pretty exciting. I gotta say, you know, as a person who is super lazy and doesn't often like to just even bother touching my phone to set up the Apple TV.
You just want the cakes to fly into your mouth.
Yes. I'm stoked at, like, all the stuff, you know, all the different art house options for streaming apps that we have now on our Apple TV, and it makes me want to go, not be lazy.
You and I just told an anecdote about how we had to go to the video store, to the one gay video store.
Oh,
in
and
Dallas.
I lived in Fort Worth, Texas at the time. By the way,
yeah.
So 40 minute drive.
All you kids have to do is park your tukus on the sofa and get on your Apple TV or your Roku or whatever, and boom, the world of cinema.
30 free days and then 50% off for 3 months.
Yeah.
I got to say, like, I hate spending money, but that's a deal.
That's such a deal. Filmmovement.com. Sorry, filmmovementplus.com.
Yeah, don't forget the plus, because Film Movement is the company.
Yes,
they put out the DVDs and the Blu-rays.
And they're a film distributor.
But the plus.
Film Movement Plus is what we're talking about.
It's like Disney Plus, but 10,000 times better.
Yes, good luck finding Pelle the Conqueror on Disney Plus. You're not gonna. So, all right. So let's say we have a hypothetical listener. We actually have a couple of Boys in the Band specific letters this week.
Do we?
That we can read.
Okay.
But, you know, say you want to open those doors further wide to people to look at, like, this is what queer life was like before Stonewall or, you know, in the 70s. Where would you start them? Where would you send them? I'll start.
Okay. You just stumped Sola.
Sorry. Okay.
Which is how you know it's not really Sola, because she's unstumpable.
Yeah, that is correct.
That's the joke of the title of the show.
So I taught a course about gay and lesbian cinema for a while at Chapman. And after starting off with the documentary, The Celluloid Closet, based on the Vito Russo book, which is an essential, I think, starting off point for even understanding, like, how LGBT characters have been presented in mainstream Hollywood cinema, I would take a look at a movie that I got to host on TCM this summer.
I was about to say the same thing.
Victim.
I was going to say a different title.
Oh, okay.
But go on.
I see what you're saying. Starring Dirk Bogarde. It was the first British film that had the word homosexual in it.
Yeah.
He plays a married barrister who discovers that a young man that he'd been involved with had committed suicide rather than give Dirk Bogarde's name to a blackmailer, and this drives Bogarde to smash the blackmailing ring, even if it means exposing himself and his sexuality in, you know, in the papers. And then also another film out of the UK, although from an American director, The Killing of Sister George,
yep.
Starring Beryl Reed, right? Susanna York.
Yes.
Beryl Reed, Susanna York, and Coral Brown, which was about a lesbian love triangle in London in the 60s. So those are kind of like, again, I think they fall in the category of the Boys in the Band, where we look back at them and we think, well, that is not the world as I know it now. But if you talk to people who were around then, they will tell you that those were pretty reflective of the world as it was then. In fact, actually, Killing of Sister George had some scenes filmed in a real lesbian bar in London. I think one woman got fired from her job when somebody saw her in the movie.
Oh no!
Yeah, but it was very much like they were on the beat. They were going to the real places and shooting there.
Our betters.
Okay.
Tyrell Davis.
Yes.
Shows up in the last 5 minutes of this George Cukor comedy from 1933.
A literal drawing room farce.
And turns everything upside down.
Yeah.
As
Ernest.
His name was Ernest. The character's name is Ernest. And you have never seen anyone like this in a film. I cannot get enough of him. May we all be so bold. May we all be so self-possessed and bold as to stomp into a room and start exclaiming things about passionate dancing.
Yeah, bossing around everybody.
Yeah. This was an era in which queer characters were often either not discussed or known as the pansy.
Yes.
And staggering, this guy. Like, you want to see the fun of the past? You go to this one.
Yeah, for sure.
You want to see the agony? You watch Victim.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Boys
or,
the Band.
Or the Children's Hour, or the Sergeant, or the Fox.
Or the Detective.
Or the Detective. Like, those are the movies about, like, oh, you're queer? Well, you're going to have to die at the end of the film. Very sorry to,
if you don't
sorry
kill yourself,
to inform you.
Someone else is going to kill you.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I'm all with it on those films. If you want to see some renegade stuff, then you go to the 1960s and you watch Scorpio Rising, you watch Flaming Creatures, you watch like any Andy Warhol movie. You know,
Hollywood Lawn in Trash.
Yeah. Or then you start at the new queer cinema where there's like this angry renegade sort of spirit as well. You know, that was, as I said earlier, I came out into the land of ACT UP.
Right.
And so did you.
Yeah.
That's where we were when we were young, and that's what was happening in the world when you and I came out.
Right. I think the difference being that I was more familiar with older stuff, so
right.
I think that gave me a better understanding of why the newer stuff was so revolutionary and important.
In your face.
And paradigm shifting. You know?
Right.
But yeah, so by all means, the films you mentioned, Poison, Living End, Go Fish.
Right.
But
Paris is Burning.
But, you know, also those, in the 80s, we did get Desert Hearts and Parting Glances, both of which were very...
Neither of which I saw in a theater in the 80s. I had to wait
me neither.
Video. The only ones I saw...
I saw
My Beautiful Laundrette and Prick Up Your Ears.
Yes.
And then later I saw Torch Song Trilogy.
Yes, I saw that one in the theater too. Oh my God. I've told this story too probably, but watching Prick Up Your Ears and My Beautiful Laundrette probably, both of them sitting next to one of my dearest friends in the world, Kurt Holman, before I was out to him.
Right.
And just like... Anytime anything remotely sexy was going on in those movies, just being like, don't react, don't respond, don't say anything, don't flinch. You know, that's the kind of liar's poker you learn when you're deeply in the closet.
No boners.
Well, I don't think he would have noticed that, thankfully, but I just meant like I couldn't, you know, must not clutch chest to go, ooh. You know, that
right, sort of thing. Right.
Why don't you read the...
I got a letter.
Okay.
Dr. Steve.
Yes.
Most prolific writer of letters, Dr. Steve.
Bless him.
He says, I enjoyed the new Boys in the Band, which is the only version I've seen.
Ah, okay.
Others who grew up with the original gave it mixed reviews, including Alonzo. And I can understand that. What surprises me is how many gay friends have said to me that they are not interested in either version.
Hmm.
They feel the characters are too petty and cruel to each other, and that it is a negative portrayal of gay men that they cannot stomach. I'm new to the movie. This part of the discussion is new to me, too. Could you speak to this view of the movie and how you feel about it? Well, we just did. But if you are a queer person of any age and you have not seen the original... And you care about film, and you care about the evolution of queer culture,
and representation,
and what the visibility and representation, you know, elements of it mean. You kind of have to watch the original. You don't have to watch this one, this new one, but you kind of do have to watch the original if you want to be able to say, "Look, I know what that building block was.
Right. And speaking of the notion of the...
Without taking it personally, it's not about you.
Yeah.
It's about the film. It's about the past.
Speaking to the notion of the characters being cruel and petty, there is an oft-quoted...
They are.
They are. No question. And there's an oft-quoted line towards the end where Michael says, if only we could learn not to hate ourselves quite so much.
Right.
And so, you know, I think the play is sort of... is saying, like, these people are awful and y'all made us this way.
Right.
You know, this is what society has done to us because we have grown up with such deep self-loathing and such deep misunderstanding of ourselves.
That when we fight each other instead of
nurturing each other,
keeping ourselves as a shelter, we attack each other in the way that we were attacked.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not a bug, it's a feature.
Andrew says, hey, Alonzo and Dave, happy anniversary.
Thank you.
And happy 10 years of podcasting. Well, that's next month.
That's coming up.
Yeah. I'm listening to the Ava review right now, and I thought I would ask about how the personal histories of the creative teams behind the films impact the way viewers or critics react to a film when it comes to watching or reviewing their work. I mention this because Matthew Newton was the writer for Ava and at one point was attached to direct it, as well, before public outcry about past abuses pushed him off the project. This is news to me. He was accused of domestic violence.
Yes.
Against former partners Brooke Satchwell and Teresa Palmer. Hmm. And became a persona non grata in Australia, leading him to pursue a career in America. Mention his name in Australia, and you'll get the same response as mentioning Kevin Spacey or Woody Allen. But unlike Woody Allen or Kevin Spacey, I've noticed that with a fair few reviews of Ava, there is little mention of Newton's past. That's because he has done a very good job of not having that be in the public eye.
Yeah.
And American media has not... he's not enough of a known person in the right. United States for the media to pick up on this stuff. And
yeah,
they just did it.
Like, I mean, there was even a rap article about this, and I had just never seen it. I didn't know any of this until...
He includes a link to the rap article.
Yeah. Like, you know, one of our Australian listeners, sort of in commenting on my review on Facebook, told me this story, and I was like, first I'm hearing
what?
Of any of this. Yeah.
Not
an excuse, it just is.
He continues, does this matter? Is there an ethical need for reviewers to be abreast of all the past actions of a creative team, whether it be a director or actor or writer or producer, and to keep their readers and followers aware of where their money might be going when viewing a film, or is it up to the viewer to keep track of these salient issues? Additionally, does one problematic person ruin a film?
These are good questions.
If I attempted to dig into the lives of every person on a creative team in a film... Mm. I would exhaust myself before I ever got
to evaluate
to watch the movie.
Yeah.
Also this. No one is good in this life. I don't know what that's supposed to mean to the work that they do. Now, Ava makes it easy by being a bad film.
Yes.
But what if Ava had been a great film?
Right.
We would still be stuck with the knowledge of this guy. But again, after the fact.
Yeah.
Very much like the knowledge of, Disney filmed Mulan in the part of China where they've got, you know...
The Uyghur detention camps.
A genocide getting underway. And so, this is a question I don't have an answer for. I don't know... It would have made me personally... not want to watch it at all.
Well, I think also because it's the kind of... it is a negligible movie that could have been ignored without it being like a big gap in our coverage. When I went to Venice last year and there was a new Roman Polanski movie.
Yes.
I had to review it.
Right.
I was asked by my bosses to review it.
Yes.
He is still a major international filmmaker.
Yes.
I had to go see it. And I... went in giving that movie as much benefit of the doubt as possible.
Yeah.
I didn't want to not like it just because I don't like, what
the things he did.
Has done and how he's dealt with it in the aftermath, And as it turns out, I didn't like the movie for reasons that had nothing to do with that stuff.
Right.
But, you know, I'm there to review the work and not the artist.
That becomes a problem, because the more you know and the more troubling, you know, their actions have been.
Yeah.
It cannot help but color your perception of the art.
Sure.
You know, like I just said, if I had known about this guy before watching Ava, I'd have been like, you know what? I don't have to watch this stupid movie. If he's such a creep in real life,
right,
why do I have to pay attention to anything he does? But I didn't know that until after seeing it. You know, does it affect what I think about a film after? Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
It does. And again, it's what you, you know, are. It's everyone has their line.
Yeah.
You know? We watched The Ref at Christmas time. Not so into it anymore.
No.
You know, it retroactively sort of spoiled it for me. And that's my line.
Yeah.
Right? So I don't know where anyone else's is. I still don't know this guy. His name is Matthew Newton.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what he is accused of having done. I have names of his former partners, but I don't know the story at all.
Right.
And so I'd have to go hunt that down.
Gotcha.
You know, now I've got his name in my head. So I'm going to keep, now when he's got some new project coming, I'm going to be like, oh, it's that guy.
That guy.
Yeah. Anyway, he continues. I understand that there will never be an industry standard for these issues, but given how often these issues arise, I'm wondering what the baseline will be set at when it comes to discussing these films. I say that with full awareness and appreciation of the impact that these people have had on their victims. I understand this is a complex discussion that is multifaceted and hard to approach, so I thank you for your time in reading this letter. Yeah, it is hard to approach because it feels like every new instance brings in more unique information.
Yeah, next time a conservative tells you about cancel culture, remind them how many Oscars Mel Gibson got nominated for when Hacksaw Ridge came out.
Right. So, I do my best to, as a film critic, I do my best to know about, you know, the thing I'm about to see.
Yeah.
While at the same time, maintaining enough of a bubble around myself that I'm not, you know, influenced by outside information.
Not bringing that
baggage
into the theater.
Because it's hard to walk into a film with your knives sharpened.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of try not to do that as much as you can.
Yeah.
Because you're really trying to just watch the film.
Yeah.
And judge it on its merits. And then later, you find out, oh, well, this, you know, this creator, this actor, this whoever is someone reprehensible,
right,
or has done something very bad.
And we've also talked about how sometimes the work itself does dovetail with the thing that has made the artist a problem, you know, like Louis C.K.'s I Love You Daddy, you know, which is this weirdly sexist film in a lot of ways, and it was supposed to be hitting right around the time that he was, you know, being accused of treating, you know, up-and-coming female comics so badly. So it was like,
yeah,
I can't really separate these two things because they're both coming from the same place.
Right. Jordan says, long-time listener here, I've been debating asking you this for a while, and I thought it was the perfect time to do so this week since The Boys in the Band is being released. It's been advertised that they have cast exclusively gay actors. This is something that has never been a common occurrence in any kind of acting medium, and although I think everyone with empathy thinks trans actors should be playing trans roles now, the question of it being the same for cisgender queer people has been a lot more nuanced. I have a friend who is pretty firm in saying that he has never really seen a straight actor deliver an amazing performance as a gay character. There was always something there for him that feels false. People like Tony Kushner, however, have been opposed to this kind of thing before. When Andrew Garfield was playing Prior Walter on Broadway, he asked about how this would work in an audition setting. For example, would you expect every auditioner to reveal their sexuality, something not everyone is comfortable doing?
Right.
I'm asking you two this question because I have a deep respect for your opinions. Well, there's your first mistake, Jordan. And as gay men, you probably have more worthwhile thoughts than me. Did the casting of exclusively gay actors and boys in the band add to the material? Have there been straight actors playing gay roles who you thought were fantastic? Timothy Chalamet in Call Me By Your Name or Rooney Mara in Carol. Carol are two recent examples that I thought were outstanding, although opinions vary. And even if they can give great performances as queer characters, should they still be in the running? Now, so what do we think about the all-gay cast of Boys in the Band? We discussed it. It matters on that other textual level. You know?
Sure, yeah.
It matters historically, like we said. It matters that, oh, we have all these household names or, right, you know, relatively famous people who are openly queer now. You know, yeah, that's good.
I think this is a question that operates on multiple levels, because I think there is there's the genuine thing of like, okay, are openly gay actors, openly LGBT actors, also being hired to play non-LGBT characters?
Yes.
Because if right, they are not,
then that's a problem.
Then they should absolutely right, get first and only crack at the LGBT characters if that's all they're going to get cast as. On a second level, I think trans is different. I think that absolutely trans characters should be played by trans actors, and that it's gimmicky otherwise.
I am in full agreement with you on that, because, you know, we've now had some time to work out the idea of a straight person playing gay or a gay person playing straight, but it's not like there have been like an avalanche of films about trans people.
Exactly.
But there are lots of trans actors out there who routinely were passed over for parts.
Yes.
And
who also aren't getting cast in cis roles.
And so give them their shot.
Yeah.
And let a trans person play a trans character.
I have an interesting anecdote with this, actually. When the documentary about Terrence McNally came out a couple of years ago, and it's now streaming. If you haven't watched it, it's great. You should. I hosted a Q&A at Outfest, and one of the panelists was the great Rita Moreno.
Yes.
And she talked about being in his play, The Ritz.
Yes.
Googie Gomez, the character she played, was actually sort of based on this character that she would like do at parties.
Yes.
And he kind of wrote this play around her. And she talked about how there's a character in the play who is a very forward gay man, and who...
When you say forward, what are you talking
like
about?
He's very... he's not flamboyant necessarily, but he's... And he's not rapacious, but he's unapologetically gay. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Sexually?
That
it's set in a bathhouse.
It is. Yeah.
So sexually assertive, sexually assertive, aggressive.
Thank you.
Even
that's,
maybe
that's the word I wanted. And she said originally,
I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
Originally, a gay actor was cast in the role, and mind you, this is the 70s, so it's a whole other era, a whole other planet.
Yeah,
he had spent so much of his life sort of being in the closet and as an actor kind of tamping down anything that somebody could look at and go, oh, that's a gay guy, that his performance was really kind of stifled and flat and unconvincing. And so they wound up firing him and they cast F. Murray Abraham.
Right.
Who is a straight guy, but who was completely unafraid to throw himself into the character and the character's behavior and the possibilities of how that character would exist on the stage.
Yes.
And he nailed it.
Right.
And so she sort of brought that up, not to say, oh, gay characters should be played by straight guys, but that there was at least a time when gay men in particular were, and lesbians also, were so trained by society to alter their own behavior and monitor their own behavior and second guess their own instincts, that they weren't comfortable playing gay as comfortable playing gay roles as straight people.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. Nowadays, obviously, it's a different story. And I think, you know, I'm not going to say no, straight people should never play gay roles, but I think
Heath Ledger is great in Brokeback Mountain.
I would say, and Jake Gyllenhaal both. Yeah, like there are plenty of examples. The two you cited, and Cate Blanchett also in Carol.
Yeah.
But you know, there's part of me that thinks like there was somebody who got in my face on Twitter or somewhere because on Breakfast All Day we were talking about how Lulu Wang was saying that Ron Howard shouldn't be directing this biopic about a famous Chinese classical musician.
Okay.
That it should be an Asian director.
Okay.
Specifically a Chinese director.
Yes.
And then this person tried to counter that, oh, well, then that means it was racist for Chloe Zhao to make The Rider.
No.
And it's like, you know what? Let's have a century
right.
of artists of color getting to make stories about white people.
Yep.
And then you can come at me and say yep. that it's racist to do it that way.
Yes.
And so it's kind of how I feel about straight actors playing gay roles. It's like there are some that do it well and have done it well and could do it well. Let's have 100 years of them not doing this. And then we'll circle back to this issue.
And in 100 years, when I am 156 years old, I will say, now you may begin
yes.
to do it the other way. I will decree this as the 156-year-old expert.
There you go. We have a 5-star review.
No, we have another letter.
Oh, we have another letter.
Okay. Linda.
Yes.
Would like to talk about Helen Reddy.
Oh, yes, yes,
the
yes.
The recently passed away Helen Reddy. Her film is still in virtual cinemas.
Yes, I Am Woman, the biopic yeah. about her.
She says, I was a teenager during Helen Reddy's time on the charts and just beginning my feminist education. And at the time, there didn't really seem to be much disparity between her feminist anthem and the female victims in her other songs.
Yeah.
One of the things that was happening in feminism at the time, as I recall, was talking out loud about the terrible things men do to women.
Hmm.
A huge best-selling book at the time was The Height Report, H-I-T-E, which essentially laid out for all to see that men just sucked at having sex with women. Men are the worst was a strong thread in feminism at the time. So the two types of songs didn't really seem so different. They were both about women's lives, which was kind of a new thing.
That's a very good point.
Perfect sense.
Yeah.
Thank you, Linda.
All right. We lost Helen Reddy this week and Mac Davis.
Yes.
And if you've never seen North Dallas 40, you should.
It's North Dallas 40 is so great.
It is.
This is a 5-star review from Blue Cal XKY.
Maybe
Calix, KY.
Maybe Blue Calix in Kentucky?
Well, it says they are from Great Britain, is what it says.
Oh, okay. Then I don't know what that means, but thank you for writing in.
There's a title. The title of the review is, And Then the Laughing Critics from the Muppets Renounced Their Cynical Ways. Where is this going?
This is not the first nor last person to compare us to Statler and Waldorf.
If you glance at the date attached to this review, you will notice that I'm writing this while knee deep in 2020. The world is a terrifying place full of wealthy psychopaths and greenhouse gases, and thanks to the pandemic, asking for a hug gets a similar reaction to that of drawing an ice pick. I've tried a lot of methods for soothing my lockdown nerves, and I'm both shocked and grateful that the most reliable one so far comes in podcast form. Oh, this is us.
Yeah.
Oh, you're talking about us.
Yes. It's a 5-star review of this show, Dave.
Linoleum Knife consists of two married film critics talking about their passion for cinema and occasionally baking and music. They themselves acknowledge that, on paper at least, there is very little to distinguish them from hundreds of other podcasts. However, it is their welcoming ethos, their good-natured curiosity, and their effortless neighborly warmth that makes this one so special. I'm so grateful for these people and for this show. The fact that I get a steady stream of great film recommendations, old and new, is merely a bonus. I'm going to start crying now, so stop being so nice to us. It's very upsetting.
You could just leave us a 5-star review and just with a couple of sentences. You really don't have to.
You could say, I like it just fine.
Please listen.
5 stars. I like it just fine. Maybe someday when I'm 156 years old and adjudicating the proper response for Hollywood's casting, I'll be able to accept praise and a compliment in a way that isn't full of ironic distance.
But not yet.
But that day has not yet come.
No.
Thank you so much for
thank
this review.
You.
That's I'm having many feelings.
We super
right
we,
now.
We are officially reclaimed. We appreciate it. Thank you. Please do leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We will read it on the show. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and Spotify, CastBox, Podbean, Google Play, Amazon Podcasts, I believe. Anyway, check out our friends on the internet. I'm on the Christmas Clatter podcast this week, talking with host
what
Todd.
What a surprise. You're on a Christmas-themed podcast
I know.
This week.
They come...
Who could have imagined
it starts earlier
that
every
you would be
year.
Asked to do a Christmas-themed podcast?
But here's the thing.
What credentials do you have to be asked so many times to be on Christmas-themed podcasts?
We barely...
Why don't you tell them about maybe that there's a book
okay,
out there
okay,
well,
I was going to get there. But
internet.
Yes, I wrote a book called Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, which you can get at Amazon and all the places that books are sold.
That's right.
What's
coming on Christmas.
It is. What was exciting...
Chopping down trees to make books written by Alonzo Duralde about Christmas movies.
What was exciting about this episode, though, is we barely talk about movies. It was a Christmas episode where we talked about decorating and eating and all kinds of other, you know, the phenomenon of so many year-round Christmas podcasts that are happening now. It was a really fun chat. I had a great time talking to Todd. He's a sweetheart. So, Christmas Clatter, check that out. I had a really great time doing that show. Go see what our friends Bibbs and Whitney are up to over at the Critically Acclaimed Network. Listen to my other shows, please. Film and a Movie, Breakfast All Day, and Who Shot Ya. Check out The Schmoes Know, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the comics canon, Sewers of Paris, All Things Cozy, Deck the Hallmark, Fat Guys at the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Big Fat Gay Podcast, and Secretly Timid. You can follow us at Linoleum Cast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. He's got a new kids album out, so if you have children that desperately need entertaining, he's got you covered. Go follow him on Twitter at Blutopia.com, Blutopia. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments. We will be back next week with a whole bunch more movies, because we had no idea we had this much to say about The Boys in the Band. Thank you all for listening. We'll catch you next time. Until then,
goodbye.